The views expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of 94.9 CHRW.
Here it is, the avocado jungle. Look around you, bunny. In front of us, the lush, untouched rainforest of the last surviving matriarchy. Behind us, the polluted patriarchy of Western civilization. We're leaving a world dominated by men and entering one ruled by women.
Whoop-dee-doo. Just keep bashing men. In a couple days, you'll be dying for a Burger King out here.
I doubt it.
You know, women, you're always bitching and moaning about men and the way we run things, but let's face it, who could have ever invented but a man the 64 GTO? Or for that matter, the Corvette Stingray, any year, any model. All you women have ever done is what? Some French chick invented kryptonite or something. The important things, like beer and meat, that was all
men.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine a woman inventing nuclear weapons.
Exactly, and where would we be without them?
And the Nazi Blitzkrieg seemed like a male idea, not to mention South African apartheid. How about World War I, the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the Rape of Shanghai?
So men have done a lot of things.
Elvis Presley.
Janis Joplin.
Patton.
Joan of Arc.
How about Tammy Baker?
Jim Baker, Jerry Falwell, Jimmy Swaggart.
Jessica Hunt, Fawn Hall, Donna Wright.
Joseph McCarthy. Richard Nixon.
Joan Rivers.
Joan Rivers? I like Joan Rivers. I think she's funny.
Well, I think Nixon's funny.
Good morning, London. It's Thursday, January 29th, 2015. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughan.
And this is Just Right on CHRW 94.9 FM.
Where we'll be with you from now until noon.
It's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Today we got an interesting show for you. We're going to be talking about the concept of affirmative consent. I almost have trouble saying that word, Robert. It's such an oxymoronic concept.
I can't wait for that segment of the show. It's just really unbelievable.
And what we're going to be talking about in the first quarter, you're going to be hinting on that right now?
In the first quarter, Bob, I'm going to talk about some feedback that I got from the previous show. Listener Mark wrote, "I agree 100% with your argument about the status of animals." Now, on last week's show, I did talk about the status of animals, individual rights, animal rights, whether or not they have them or not, and status. So Mark was in agreement, and he said, "I would like to know your opinion on recreational hunting as well, though. Ought it be illegal to kill an animal strictly for the joy of it? For a purpose like food is ethical, and I would never take that sort of an argument, but I just can't justify killing sentient animals willy-nilly for the pure sake of it." Well, I'll condense what Mark is asking into one question. Should hunting for sport be illegal? Sport hunting. Although he does imply a moral component to the issue. On last week's show, I tried to show a progression of thought which led me to conclude that animals, while they do not have rights, have status in law and that such a status is proper. Such status gives rise to laws preventing cruelty to animals but does not prevent us from killing them. I gave several examples and reasons, what I thought were rational reasons for killing some animals at times, those being, of course, food, clothing, or the advancement of science. There's others, including culling a herd of deer, for example, which might be causing too many traffic fatalities, or shooting coyotes if they encroach on urban areas, as one did just last week here in London. Much to the chagrin and to the anger of a lot of the people who thought, maybe let's keep this rabid coyote walking around Wortley Village. You know, why not?
Is it actually rabid?
Well, they said that it may have been rabid. Although one caller to a talk-in show said that it was probably just distemper, which is a different kind of an ailment altogether. But who wants to be...
You want to
err on the side of safety,
animal.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, these are preventative safety reasons, and I'm sure there's plenty of other reasons that you may want to kill animals. But the question raised is, should sport or human pleasure be a legitimate reason to kill a sentient animal? I'll give a qualified yes as my answer. Rights are a necessary man-made construct applying only to men in a social context. And I pointed out that last week that not all men have all rights, and for very good reason. We deny the rights to contract and to liberty to children and those who are mentally impaired. People often forfeit their freedom and sometimes their right to life by denying others their right to life, liberty, or property without their consent. Such people are criminals and are properly imprisoned for our protection. Sentient, non-human animals, insofar as they interact with man, have only status. Such a status prevents us from committing acts of cruelty upon them, which is proper, and such status is usually applied based on the nature of the animal and where it lies on various physiological scales. Is it sentient? Can it feel pain? Does it emote? Is it capable of understanding language? There's another criteria, and this is ownership or custody. Whose animal is it? Whose property is it?
Right.
Or whose custody is it?
Yeah.
I'm having just a little difficulty with my headset here.
No, sorry. You're okay. I'm hearing you fine.
Yeah, good. Okay. Based on such criteria, we don't care what we do to, for example, snails, but we do care what we do to gorillas. There's a spectrum or a gradient of the physiological characteristics of animals which we recognize and give appropriate status based on where on that spectrum a particular animal falls. Now, while I personally don't see the sport in hunting an animal simply for a trophy to hang on the wall, there are those who do see value in it, and their choice should be respected as long as the kill is done humanely, i.e. with the minimum amount of pain as is practical, and that you have the permission, of course, of the owner or the authority in charge of the animal. These are not the days of the open frontier. Every bit of land in the world is either under the jurisdiction of a private individual or a government. The private jurisdiction is simple. If you own the land and the animals on it, they're yours to hunt for sport as you see fit, with, of course, that caveat of being humane applying. Now, whether or not the government should own land at all is another question, but it remains that they do, and therefore have jurisdiction over the animals on their land, and most governments allow hunting for sport at certain times and for specific animals, usually for rational reasons. They might wish to limit the spread of a species like deer, or they may want to maintain a population, such as with the bear. But all in all, the reasons governments allow hunting, they're usually rational reasons. But I think Mark's question is more of an ethical one than a legal one. Should it be moral to kill another sentient non-human animal for sport? I won't include the slaughter of elephants for their tusks or the killing of bears for their gallbladders, because such cases are always cases of a poacher violating the rights of the people who have jurisdiction of those animals, usually a government with custody of the animals on reserves or government-controlled land. An animal in the wild faces a death, usually of being eaten alive. An animal in the wild, whether a deer or a gorilla, rarely dies of old age. Their deaths are usually gruesome and painful, typically arising from being attacked, for being diseased, or for being the runt of the litter, usually by a predator bigger or faster than or smarter than them. In the end, the natural death for an animal in the wild is far more grisly than a death by a bullet or an arrow at the hands of man. If such a death gives a hunter some element of satisfaction, then that's a value I think that we should respect and protect. The hunter is not being cruel, he's simply being the predator who is stronger, faster, or smarter in a world filled with predators and their prey. I'll make an exception which I may be challenged on because it might seem to contradict what I just said. Referring back to the spectrum or scale of physiological characteristics which give some animals status, and while leaving some without the benefit of such status, I think there's a class of animals which we should prohibit the killing for of sport. In particular, the great apes, which show such intelligence and kinship to humans, I believe that they should be left alone. Gorillas, for one, have shown the mental capacity of young humans. They're capable of exhibiting the same emotions we do for apparently the same reasons. Coco with a gorilla can sign over 1,000 words and is capable of understanding, if her handlers are to believe, over 2,000 spoken English words. This fact alone places gorillas well above the moose, on the what shall we kill today scale. It may be argued that some cetaceans, like dolphins, should be protected for their intelligence, as most jurisdictions do offer that protection. And just as individual human rights are not cut and dried and have their exceptions, so too should the granting of status to various members of the non-human club. The concept of individual human rights is only a few hundred years old. Applying some degree of status to animals is a much more recent concept than that. We're talking about an evolving philosophy of the role of non-humans in a human world. And while humans should always come out on top, there's no rational reason to suggest that we treat all members of the great amorphous continuum of life on this planet the same. It only stands to reason that an entity's nature be taken into account when dealing with it in human context. And so, Bob, with that said, let's see how many English words a chicken can understand.
Erman, come on, beat, beat. I need another egg for the souffle.
Hey, good chap, Erman. Give over or out, whichever is easier.
Erman, come on.
Hi, any luck?
Unless he shapes up no souffle tonight.
Watch this. Chicken, this is your commanding officer speaking. You lay an egg, and that's an order. Nobody respects officers anymore.
Any action?
Nothing. That chicken's a ruddy crowd, if you ask me. Stubborn.
New Kirk, name-calling never solves anything.
Come on, darling. I want the souffle tonight. Come on, Jicky, come on.
Herman.
Oh, that's great. Was it something I said?
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. A triumph of willpower over the orgasm. At a rally of the Anti-Sex League in Victory Square tonight, held to celebrate a 50% decrease in civil marriages, over 10,000 party women took a vow of celibacy.
I just want to finish by saying a few words about the impact of this imminent neurological breakthrough. When the orgasm has been finally eradicated, the last remaining obstacle to the psychological acceptance of the principles of Ingsoc will be overcome. In other words, the unorthodox tendencies towards own life, which constantly threaten the natural erosion of the family unit, will no longer have the biological support of the organism. As we all know, the biological and social stimulation of the family leads to private reflection outside party needs, and to the establishment of unorthodox loyalties, which can only lead to thought crime. But the introduction of ArtSem, combined with the neutralization of the orgasm, will effectively render obsolete the family until it becomes impossible to conceptualize.
Power is tearing human minds apart and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Power is not a means. Is an end. When we can cut man from his family, his children, other men, there is no loyalty except loyalty to the party. There is no love except love of Big Brother. All competing pleasures we will destroy. If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
And that was from the 1984 film, 1984. And, you know, interesting subject we're having here today. You know, when left-wing governments and interests begin a process of legally defining fundamental concepts and meanings in order to destroy their original concept, then I think it's time to sound the red alert. The issue is consent, and as with all the words in our various dictionaries, when you place an adjective in front of it, the original concept practically ceases to exist. Consent is the ruling principle of any society that can call itself a civilization, and it usually implies the absence of force or coercion in any relationship between two or more people capable of consent. Now, current attempts to implement an oxymoronic concept called affirmative consent would make the absence of force or coercion a moot point. It would become almost irrelevant. The political process is underway, and it affects everything from our relationships with our friends and spouses, the sex education our children will receive in our schools, and is at the heart of one of the least understood controversies of the day, the Bill Cosby allegations, which, by the way, as of a couple days ago, now total 31. We'll talk about that a little later, and the campaign behind it. This is not an easy political phenomenon for people to wrap their heads around, so to help us with that task, we're pleased and delighted to have with us today, on the phone, live line, Freedom Party leader Paul McKeever join us for the balance of our show today. Paul, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, fellas.
Oh,
hi,
great Paul. To have you here. Now, just a couple days ago, you released an interesting piece called Simon Says Sex, The Nature and Purpose of Affirmative Consent, which was released to the media and to all the members of provincial parliament. And
right.
Tell us a bit about that, because I'll tell you, that one caught me by surprise, and you sure hit some nails on the head in that, in terms of what we've been talking about on the show recently.
Well, this is going to hit people by surprise, and hopefully it won't hit them too late. The affirmative consent just sounds like, you know, double plus good, you know, good consent. It's not, though. It's a very particular term, and it was developed in 1993 as a matter of one college's policy on sexual offense prevention. And it read like this. It gave a brand new definition for consent, or a way of determining when there is consent. It says, quote, "Consent means verbally asking and verbally giving or denying consent for all levels of sexual behavior. The person with whom sexual conduct is initiated must verbally express, quote, consent, unquote, or lack of, quote, consent, unquote. Each new level of sexual activity requires consent. Silence conveys a lack of consent." So it switches entirely the whole way we think of just about everything in contract law, law in general, from one in which silent, you know, Jimmy, you know, moves toward Sarah for a kiss, and Sarah maybe extends her face forward for a kiss and puckers her lips, and they kiss. Sarah did not consent under this policy, because silence is not consent. She literally has to say the words yes, or yes, kiss me, or etc.
So,
each new level, apparently, this has to be done again. So if he wants to now kiss her neck, he would say, "May I now kiss your neck?" And she would have to say yes. And if she didn't, silence means no consent, means there is not consent, and therefore he has sexually assaulted her.
This is inhuman.
It's completely ridiculous.
It defies human nature.
Well, it was so ridiculous at the time, 1993. The college was called Antioch College. It was a little liberal arts college in the States. And Saturday Night Live actually picked up on it and did a skit, which I think you'll be hearing later.
Yeah, we'll be playing that later, and it's just, you know, Paul, I have to tell you, even when I read your original report and we've had this discussion together, even I, who will accept a lot of those things just on face value, have a hard time wrapping my head around this, that anybody would even go there. And yet it explains so much of what's happening, in particular behind a lot of the Cosby allegations, which I noticed you made a very brief reference to in your report, along with some other people who were caught in this trap. And it seems that I wasn't that far off then when I said at the beginning that the actual absence of force or coercion in a relationship is almost becoming a moot point in terms of how the law would define consent under these circumstances.
Well, that's right. In fact, I give a couple of examples in my paper that, you know, one person asks for a kiss, the other person nods yes, does the dance of the seven veils, lies back on the bed, invites the other person to come to the bed, extends out for a kiss, and then the kiss happens, and that person's committed sexual assault because no one said yes, and that's literally the way this gets interpreted. So it takes away from evidence and consideration anything other than verbal yes and verbal no. In other words, all kinds of physical actions that anyone would use to either request or to get or to consent to any kind of physical interaction is irrelevant. We don't take that into account. Words only, and it's an evidentiary standard. The effect of it is all sex means rape, except where someone said yes. That's it. And the intention, of course, is to establish a guilty until proven innocent standard. It's a reversal of the onus. Every sexual act is an act of sexual assault unless and until someone can prove, probably beyond a, you know, a reasonable doubt, that the complainant said yes with her words, not with a nod, not with a touch, not with a pulling someone closer to her, but using the word yes. And of course, it sets up a legal minefield for anybody, whether you're heterosexual, homosexual. Doesn't make it applies to all kinds of homosexual and heterosexual contact, and it basically sets up a minefield so bad that most people will probably say, "To heck with it! I'd rather be celibate than put my neck in the noose."
What if you're going out with somebody, or not even going out, let's say just having sex with somebody who's a deaf mute or speaks a different language, and even though, you know, the language of love is supposedly universal, they don't understand English, and, you know, there's no consent involved there.
Well, there's the language barrier. There's also the age barrier. Consider this. And you know, I just noticed this the other day. I was looking at a quotation I put in my paper from the newspaper, Toronto Star, January 7th, and this is the Wynne government, which has now said they're going to put consent into their sex ed program that they're going to be releasing in a month or two. But listen to this very closely. Wynne has asked Education Minister Liz Sandals, quote, to find a new health and physical education curriculum that gets at some of the root causes of gender inequality.
Oh, boy.
Wait a minute, that's
What's
not
that?
Sexual assault. But this isn't about, but she continues and says, and starts at the very earliest stages to develop an understanding of healthy relationships and consent. So they're passing off what's going to be feminist theory as a theory of consent. And of course, it's exactly where it comes from. The people who proposed affirmative consent in the first place were radical feminists at Antioch College. And the current effort in California, they just passed a law, says that if you want to continue receiving money at your university, you have to adopt affirmative consent. Not just consent, mind you. Affirmative consent. Only yes means yes. Everything else means rape. You know, you've got to ask yourself why anybody would want this. But quite apart from that, as you said, what about the person who can't speak English? What about the person who's 7 years old? And they're being told in, I don't know what grade you're in, say grade two or three, by the Wynne government's new proposed sex policy, that yes means yes. Well, it does not mean yes if you're a child. There's no words on earth that could allow a child to consent to any kind of sexual contact.
It sounds as if that this affirmative consent may be what is known as grooming of children to be, looking forward to sex. All you got to do is say yes. Say yes, and then, you know. Yes,
well,
means yes.
Yeah, but then everything's good to go, right?
Yeah.
Well, no, things aren't necessarily good to go. There are a lot of other things that come into play, the age of the person, the context. But just imagine what this does. If we start teaching 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds that yes means yes and that sex is good, which it is, I agree, sex is great for adults, for people capable of consenting. But for children to go out there and think, because all they can really grasp through all the legalese that they're going to hear in class is that somehow yes means yes, they go out, and some 18-year-old or 25-year-old or 49-year-old says to the child, "Do you want to do this?" The child says yes. She figures she's consented. Mm-hmm. Don't think that these groomers out there, these sexual predators, won't take advantage of affirmative consent if it's taught to children. That's a real concern, and I've written this in part and sent it to the MPPs precisely so that they will be careful when they're developing the sex ed program not to teach that yes means yes for a child, not to teach it in a way that children might think it does mean yes for them.
Well, teaching children who are not capable of consent about consent is good on one level, but certainly is fraught with dangers on another. It's funny. I'm trying to wrap my head still around who's behind this and why California went ahead with this. I'm reading in the papers here, even at the University of Western Ontario here, Western University, they call it now, in the Gazette, and I hear constantly all these programs they're putting in to essentially bring in concepts like this into the thinking at all colleges and universities. Is there some problem they're trying to address with these draconian concepts, and why, again, this whole thing just seems patently insane to me. It's just on the level of it, that you can't consent through your actions, that your actions don't mean anything. And then how would someone prove, okay, there's only two people in a bedroom most of the time, who the heck's going to be the witness to say that one of them said yes or didn't? It's still, you're right back where you were to begin with.
He said, she said.
Yeah, how does it change anything except that now this stupid law's on the books? That law has to be there for a reason, and it's certainly not for verifying whether consent occurred in a certain circumstance, because that's impossible unless there's a third witness or you're recording.
That's right. And so what is the effect of the law? Is there any effect of the law? Absolutely. The effect is that every sexual act becomes a rape from the get-go, and you have to prove it was otherwise.
Oh, wow.
That's the effect. That's the intended effect. And what it does, of course, is creates this legal minefield where anybody can later on say, well, you know, Simon says kiss my lips, Simon says kiss my neck, touch my bum. Wait a minute, I didn't say Simon says. Guess what? You're guilty of sexual assault. I mean, that's a bit of an absurd example, but it gets across the danger of this kind of system, that anybody who has sex is guilty. Both of them are guilty.
You know,
from the get-go.
In your parties. In your blog, Paul, you say that the intent or the consequence is to replace love and respect between men and women with fear, distrust, disrespect, animosity, and hatred. I have to agree with you. There can only be one reason to promote such a stupid law, and that is to do exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, two people if they understand this policy well and they're trying to follow it, it's absolutely absurd. And you know, I just can't see people doing it, first of all, and I can see all kinds of abuse that is potential. So can anybody see the potential abuse here. But I think really what somebody is trying to do, and we can talk about who that is later, but what somebody is trying to do is make each of the parties in that room or that place so distrustful of the other that they just say, you know what, I don't trust you. I can't trust you because the law doesn't allow me to trust you. As soon as we touch, we've had there's been a sexual assault. You of me of you, under the chestnut tree, as it were, and now it's just a question of which one of us wants to run to the police first and say that the other guy didn't say yes with his mouth.
No, that you know, it's funny you just said with his mouth. Can you put it in writing? I guess you can't. Writing doesn't count anymore, does it? It has to be verbal. That makes it even more nebulous. It's even less provable. They've almost created, let's pick the type of evidence that can't be proven one way or the other so that we can have our cake and eat it too kind of approach. I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, mark my words, and I know you're coming up on the bumper here, but there are people who will benefit from this. There are people who will benefit from a system that drives people apart, that makes sex something that's too risky, especially between men and women, where, you know, there's all kinds of historic problems and current problems between men and women, real problems that we see, you know, people who really are charged with sexual assault, et cetera. And so to exploit that with this new redefinition of the way in which you determine consent, there's a goal here, and the goal, the means to it, is to drive people apart. Mm. But it also not just in terms of driving them apart from sexual contact, but literally to drive men and women apart as well, because they tend to be heterosexual sex is the most common type.
Are you saying that Kathleen Wynne, who is a lesbian, has a lesbian agenda here with this introduction?
I don't think there's a lesbian agenda. I think there's certainly a cultural Marxist agenda. To drive women and men into separate collectives, to make them think and fear one another. Men fearing that women are going to stick their head in the noose and accuse them of rape. Women fearing that they're going to be raped. Both sides being told we live in a rape culture. We better stick to ourselves. We better not trust each other. And why all this, you know, why bother having sex? Better to stay home and play Nintendo. There's several articles, incidentally, recently that are suggesting this is, in fact, a growing trend. There's actually terminology being used, popular terms, for men and women who have just decided not to bother dating, not to bother going out. Japan's quite a bit like this. Very much a stick to yourself and who needs the bother. And it serves well those who want to drive us into separate collectives.
Well, it certainly speaks to the comments made in that 1984 opener that we had there, and I know that you referenced that in your presentation that you sent out as well. And you also referenced the following Saturday Night Live clip that we're about to hear that was actually aired in 1993 originally, and I just can't believe how accurately they spoofed what we're talking about today as becoming a real law. I mean, it's just beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned. Let's listen into this and we'll continue our conversation when we return.
Live from Antioch College in Antioch, Ohio, it's time to play
Is It Daybreak?
With your host, the Dean of Intergender Relations, Dean Frederick Whitcomb.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, students and faculty, we've got an exciting show. Back with us is our defending champion. She's a junior and a major in victimization studies. Say hello to Ariel Halpern-Strauss. And our challenger, he's a nose tackle and a Sigma Alpha Epsilon brother. Say hello to Mark Strobel. Welcome, players. Let's take a look at our board. The categories are Halter Top, She Was Drunk, I Was Drunk, Kegger, Off Campus Kegger, She Led Me On, I Paid for Dinner, and Raging Kegger. All right, Ariel, you're our champion. The board is yours. She Led Me On. It is the last day of school. A female student asks a male student to help her move her futon. Halpern-Strauss.
Date rape.
Well, I didn't even finish the question, but it is date rape. Okay, for those of you not familiar with the rules to our game, it's quite simple. Antioch College defines date rape as any sexual contact or conduct between two or more persons in which consent to such contact, which includes the touching of thighs, genitals, buttocks, or the breast chest area, is not expressly obtained in a verbal manner. If the level of sexual intimacy increases during an interaction, i.e. if two people move from kissing while fully clothed to undressing for direct physical contact, and the people involved do not express their clear verbal consent before moving to that new level, that too is date rape. All right, Mark, you get the board.
Come on, Halter Top.
I Paid for Dinner. She orders a steak and a shrimp cocktail. Strobel.
Not date rape.
Oh, sorry. Halpern-Strauss, would you like me to finish the question?
Date rape.
Correct.
Come on, Serpent Turp. That's like 40 bucks, man!
Let's move on. Halpern-Strauss. Halter Top. Oh, that siren means one thing. Here to help us with the question are the Antioch College date rape players.
May I compliment you on your halter top?
Yes, you may.
It's very nice. May I kiss you on the mouth?
Yes, I would like you to kiss me on the mouth.
May I elevate the level of sexual intimacy by feeling your buttocks?
Yes, you have my permission.
May I raise the level yet again and take my clothes off so that we could have intercourse?
Yes, I am granting your request to have intercourse.
Contestants.
Date rape.
Oh, sorry. Mark, what do you say? Is it date rape?
Oh, man. Date rape?
Oh, sorry. We were looking for it is not date rape. Not date rape.
Oh, man, I knew it.
Hey, let's meet our contestants. Mark Strobel, you have been charged in 3 hazing deaths with 2 counts of hate speech and 1 instance of sexual harassment when you referred to the women's field hockey team as, quote, a bunch of lesbos.
Glad to be here, Dean.
All right. And over here, our lovely young champion.
Take your hands off me.
Very good. That's good for 10 points, Ariel. And you've got the board. Raging Kegger. All right, once again, the Date Rape players.
I sure had a nice time at that Raging Kegger. May I kiss you on the mouth?
Yes. Kissing me on the mouth is something I feel comfortable with. Mmm, that was nice.
Would you mind if we had sexual intercourse?
No.
Halpern Strauss.
Date rape. No always means no.
That's correct. Good job, Ariel. Bit of a trick question there.
That's a funny example. We're on the phone with Paul McKeever of the Freedom Party of Ontario, and we're discussing the concept of affirmative consent. And, of course, Paul, you've called this concept revolutionary. And instead, you said affirmative consent is not a small and innocuous precautionary step. It is revolutionary. What did you mean by that?
Well, that's the reference to the fact that what is being done here, I mean, on the one hand, you say, as I said, you know, affirmative consent, it sounds like just consent, isn't it? Aren't we just talking about consent?
Right.
So it's loaded to sound like nothing different. It's just something of affirmative and up with life and isn't the world grand. But in fact, it's a way of distinguishing consent from affirmative consent. Affirmative consent doesn't mean consent at all. It means this different way of making people behave. And that in and of itself is socially revolutionary, but legally, that's the more important way in which it's revolutionary, because what it does is it smuggles in the back door. This concept of affirmative consent smuggles in the back door a reversal of the onus from the person who is, accusing someone, having to bring evidence that they were in fact harmed. Instead, it makes the person who is accused bring evidence that they didn't do anything wrong. In other words, instead of being innocent until proven guilty, the affirmative consent approach makes everybody guilty until proven innocent. And that's revolutionary. In fact, it's absolutely evil, but it's a revolution from good to evil.
You know, you even pointed out in your report, you said the context of the current push of affirmative consent policies and how the media in 2014 put allegations of sexual assault front and center and left them there day after day with the greatest amount of reportage and opinion writing dedicated to allegations of sexual assault where no charge has been laid and no one's suing the accused and they're newsworthy. People who are wealthy, famous, influential, like Woody Allen, Prince Andrew, and Bill Cosby, for example.
Right.
And, of course, that's the pattern that I have discovered in investigating all of these allegations against Mr. Cosby, which carry no weight when you look at the bulk of them. In fact, another one just came up this week, and she's the 31st. Her name's Sidra Ladd. And, you know, she talks about having a relationship with Cosby. And apparently he asked for her number and she gave it to him. And she says, quote, we began hanging out, took in a movie. And by the way, this happened back in, I think, 1969 or something, but, you know, 50 years ago. Okay. And it just came out this week. Think about that right there. And that's something you point out, too, that there's no time limit on when you can bring these allegations forward. And all of these allegations fit your formula to a T. And she talks about how, you know, Cosby came over, they hung out, they took in a movie, they watched TV and pizza and hot dogs. And she says, his polite and unusual behavior, though, made Ladd speculate the beloved TV actor's intentions. I have to admit, she wrote, it made me wonder what his objective was. And this is in her own essay in a tabloid paper again.
A tabloid paper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course.
And then everyone else picks it up. And quite frankly, I think she'd have been in a better position and more credible if she stated what her intentions were. What's she doing inviting Cosby over to her place when she knows he's married and when she knows all these situations at the time? You know, and then she says she has a headache and that he gave her some kind of pill. And I find it interesting that a lot of these women say they had a headache before Cosby gave them a pill, as if Cosby knew they were going to get a headache if it was an intentional setup of some sort. And then they just get groggy. They have no recollection and except for the fact that they're convinced he had sex with them when they wake up or come to or 20 years later decide to talk about it. And, of course, Cosby's continued to deny all these accusations and has received support. But this is extraordinarily damaging, and it seems to me there's a pattern here. Do you have any comments on some of these things that you've heard? I know you're aware of some of them, Paul.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to necessarily get too far off topic with the particulars of the people who are making allegations, but I think what's noteworthy is that the focus is on making sure that whether it's Cosby or any other, you know, wealthy, trusted, famous, influential male, those are key, okay? They have to be wealthy, trusted people. Why do they have to be trusted, okay? They have to be trusted because we have to show that they weren't trustworthy, that our trust was misplaced, that, oh my goodness, I was wrong about, Dr. Huxtable, the character. I was wrong about the prince the prince in England. I was wrong about Woody Allen. I was wrong about all these high, wealthy, well-respected men. Every one of them is being alleged to be a rapist. So clearly, if they can be alleged to be rapists, and if the sheer volume of people alleging that Bill Cosby, did this to them, indicates that, well, he must, where there's smoke, there's fire, well, my whole world is melting. I don't think there's a single man anywhere who's not a rapist. And that is the intended effect.
You know,
wear everyone down, men and women, day after day, drip, drip, drip. Allegations are all you need. If they're frequent enough, it doesn't matter anymore. We get so sick of listening to it. We just assume that, to hell with it, it must be true. I don't want to know the details. Oh, here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one. And we get uncritical, and that's part of the plan. You don't have to be critical to believe. And, in fact, you have to be uncritical to believe if there's no evidence put forward. So this is a way of wearing down the public, making sure that we can wear down also trust between men and women. And that, I think, is at the root of this campaign that we're seeing. Everybody who's rich, famous, and male is being accused of, and some of them are guilty. I'm not saying they're not, and those people deserve all the punishment they get. But when we see these campaigns of volume that seem really scant on evidence and from sketchy sources like the National Enquirer, that should raise our alarm bells. And so what my point is here is that I think, in a sense, all of society is being groomed to distrust men, to distrust women. You'll see a lot of people who say these people are liars. I'm not in a position to know one way or another. But what I do know is that the effect, when women are called liars and when men are called rapists, is that men cease to trust women, women cease to trust men, and relations between them break down, which is exactly what is facilitated if you implement a plan like this, affirmative consent, which makes it so difficult to trust one another, and makes everyone a rapist from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I mean, by default, you're a rapist because you had sex. Now prove that you had a verbal yes somewhere in the bedroom beforehand, or else you're guilty. That is designed to make us distrust each other, designed to make us worry about being with each other. And why does this, who could possibly benefit from this? Well, anybody who doesn't want us to feel that we're all individuals first, men and women second. That our sex doesn't really make that much difference. When you take a loving relationship between a man and a woman, or between two men, or between two women, they don't particularly care about class structure and, women as a class, men as a class, who's got more money, power, wealth. They're just enjoying their lives and their love, and they're having sex in a very consensual and happy way.
Well,
So you need to tear that down if you want to make people wary of one another, make them hate each other, fear each other, and say that all men are awful, I don't want anything to do with them, all women are awful, I don't want anything to do with them. And once we've got everybody in their own little, group, their collective, then we can say, aha, look at this. The men's collective has more political power, higher positions in the job market. They're making more money. Obviously, it must be because they hate women. Obviously, it's because we live in a rape culture where every man hates every woman, and therefore we need to use force to redistribute wealth, redistribute jobs, redistribute until everything's good and equal, regardless of the individual's particular entitlements, just based on the fact that they're a member of a collective. And
you know,
that's the
Paul,
goal.
You're talking about cultural Marxism here, of course. But part of cultural Marxism, and I think it was alluded to in the 1984 novel, is the reworking of the language, newspeak. And I think affirmative consent is part of that newspeak.
Right.
It's as if there is a change out there of words and terminology that people like you and I are on the outside. Like what? We turn around and all of a sudden consent is no longer consent. It's affirmative consent. We feel alienated, almost like, what's going on? How do we come to grips with understanding these new terms? And we're going to go to a break now. And I think that they capsule it.
This is a haunting, haunting thing. This was well done in The Twilight Zone, where Robert Klein suddenly discovers he doesn't understand what's going on in the world around him anymore.
Yeah, like us today.
Yeah.
We'll be back right after this. Stay tuned, Paul.
Morning. Morning, Bill. Hey, Ginger had her litter last night. Want to see him?
Maybe later. I'm coming home for lunch. How many did she have?
Nine.
Nine?
I know. That's quite a few for a small dog like an encyclopedia. But Ginger came through like a champ.
You said encyclopedia?
Yeah.
Ginger is an encyclopedia?
Last time I looked, she was. Well, you knew that, Bill. Come on, give me a break, will you?
May I speak to Doug Seaver, please? This is Bill Lowry, McConnell Denton calling.
Listen, Bill, can I get back to you? My wife's waiting for me. Today's our 17th wedding throw rug, and I'm taking her out for a sail and then to dinner.
I'm sorry, Doug. Today's your what?
It's our throw rug.
Your throw rug?
Right. 17th. Talk to you tomorrow.
Doug, wait.
Throw rug?
Well, hi, Robert.
Oh, hey, Mr. Lowry. You know that new girl in accounting, Barbie?
Sure.
Well, I've been asking her out, and she finally says okay. She's going to be here in 5 minutes, and I can't think of any place to take her for Dinosaur. I mean, I thought of the Capitol Inn, but it might look like I'm trying too hard. What do you think?
You're planning to take this girl out for Dinosaur, huh?
That's right.
Dinosaur?
Uh-huh.
Wait a minute. You're saying Dinosaur?
Yeah.
I'll see you guys down there.
Okay. What is this, some sort of new wave expression or something, saying dinosaur instead of lunch?
No.
Then what are you talking about?
Mr. Lowry, if you don't want to... I mean, if you can't think of any place, I'll just ask somebody else.
Hi, honey.
Hi, sweetie. How was your morning?
Pretty good, I guess. Except for one really strange thing that happened. I was leaving work. This kid, Robbie, works in the mailroom. He stops me and he says...
Excuse me, sweetie, I don't mean to interrupt you, but this is going to be done pretty quick, and I wanted you to look in on Donnie before we eat.
Was something the matter?
His cold's getting worse. He's so pale and awfully congested, and he didn't touch his dinosaur when I took it in to him.
What? What did you say?
I said I think Donnie's cold is getting worse.
No. Did you say dinosaur?
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't touch it, and it's his favorite, tuna fish.
Why are you saying dinosaur?
What do you expect me to say?
Did Robbie or someone from work call you and tell you to say dinosaur as a joke or something?
Robbie? Who's Robbie? Why would he call me?
Then why are you saying dinosaur instead of lunch?
Dinosaur instead of lunch? Bill, what are you talking about?
Can't you hear what you're saying? You're saying Donnie wouldn't touch his dinosaur.
I know. And I'm a little worried.
Dinosaur? Come on, Kathy. It's lunch. The word is lunch.
Lunch? What has lunch got to do with anything?
What has lunch got to do with any? All right. Okay. What does lunch mean?
Bill, you know what lunch means.
What does it mean? Tell me!
It's a color. You know, sort of reddish, a light red. Honey, this is almost ready. Would you please go up and check on Donnie while I dish this up?
Bob, that was a chilling clip from the Twilight Zone.
Totally creepy.
And you know what drives it home for me is the fact that the original cultural Marxists who brought this forward in Paul's article were actually called Women of Antioch. Women spelled W-O-M-Y-N.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that meant, Paul?
Oh, well, they don't want anything to do with men. They don't want the word men to appear in the word women. They don't want the word man to appear in the word woman. So they take the A out, or the E out, as the case may be, and put a Y or an I, or you can put any letter you like in there. You can put dinosaur if you like. And in fact, you know, it's interesting. You've got dinosaur in that example from the Twilight Zone. It's the same as saying that the word consent, I'm not talking about affirmative consent, but the word consent, absent the word affirmative, it would be like saying that that concept is now to be called dinosaur.
Precisely.
You know, and we're not, it's a dinosaur concept. It's not even to be taught anymore. It's a color on the wall. It's, you know, but affirmative consent, which they want to teach the children, 20 years from now will be what they understand to be what we call consent. And at that point, when they are raised in a school system that tells them that basically everything's rape unless you get a word yes out of it, out of somebody first, and they distrust each other and say, what's the point of all this? We're encouraging distrust. We're encouraging a society where nobody loves each other, where everybody is just a member of a collective, paranoid that the other collective is out to skin them. I'm telling you, this is a deliberate assault, and I think we have to be very careful that we don't let the Wynne government try to pass off affirmative consent as though it's got anything to do with keeping people safe from sexual assault. It's got everything to do with driving the sexes apart, collectivizing us, and making us hate one another just enough that they can then justify wealth redistribution, job redistribution, and everything else.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's how fascinating, because, again, getting back to Sidra Ladd's allegation, and again, you're right, we don't know any of the facts of these, but what we do know is what they're throwing at us in the court, in their so-called court of public opinion, and that's all I'm going on. Mm-hmm. And what she said here was very interesting. She says she didn't lay or come forward with her allegation for almost half a century because, quote, it was a different time, and, quote, unquote, date rape was a concept that didn't exist back then. So apparently now that the concept of date rape exists, she can now retroactively put an allegation in 50 years later. But, you know, I think back 50 years ago, we still had the concept of non-consensual sex. And if she had gone to the police or reported that someone gave her a drug and then raped her while unconscious, or in her case, while she was, quote, feeling like she was floating, they would have laid charges.
Date rape is another one of those words.
No.
Rape is rape.
Yeah,
there's no need to qualify it.
Yeah,
and call it date rape, or qualifying consent to call it affirmative consent.
Precisely the same kind of term. And I find it very interesting that if you go into all of these allegations, and I mean all of them, I'm going to be summarizing this at some time in the future, you will see all of these terms being promoted. And that is what is going on. In fact, I was always wondering why, and Paul, you gave me a haunting answer to this. I said, why are they picking these specific alleges who have no cases, who will never bring their case to court, who will never be in a position to do anything about it? Literally what they're doing, in my opinion, is being allowed to libel and slander in open public. And without any consequences. And when I was asking you about this, you said something haunting to me again on this ball when we talked, and you said because it's not the men that are the enemy, it's the law in this case, or something to that effect. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, so if you line up 30 or 20 or however many people with allegations that under their law in the states can't be acted upon, the law, you know, the limitation period's timed out, if you want to make a full-scale assault on the law, if you want to say that limitation periods are wrong, what you do is you line up 20 or 30 people, you demonstrate, you know, that they're making serious allegations about someone, and then you make a point of saying that none of these people can do anything about it because the law is preventing justice from occurring. And so that may very well be the whole point of, you know, the lawyer in the States, the feminist lawyer who's been putting all these people up against Cosby, that her point probably is one that we haven't yet heard, but that eventually will turn into a campaign to eliminate limitation periods with sexual assault situations or alleged sexual assault.
Already going on. I mean, these are already parts of the patterns. You know, the allegations are all unsupportable in a court of law, as if they couldn't find one person. You know, it's funny to me, too, while most people see the number of allegations as some symbol of lack of consent or of something really bad going on, I see it as the opposite. You wouldn't. What are the odds of getting so many people to fit into this perfect pattern of not being able to support their contentions in a court of law, that the fact that they all originate in the tabloid media and the tabloid press, they all began as exclusives, including the latest one we're talking about,
paid.
Too. Yeah, and a lot of them are paid. And the release and timing of them, all orchestrated at the same time by the same interest groups and the same people. And it just goes on and on, and people are just not cluing in. How can... You know, looking to the future and trying to wrap this up, how can we communicate what's going on to the general public in a way that they can understand that this isn't necessarily what they think they're seeing?
I think what we have to remember is that consent is always, you know, something we have to understand, the proper concept of consent, but that when you hear someone telling you that all men hate women, all women can't be trusted to tell the truth, or whatever you hear, those gross generalizations, you are being fed a campaign that's designed to drive men and women, or just people, apart, to put an end to love and sex and great trusting relationships, all so that they can create a justification for massive government redistribution across between classes. And it's got nothing to do with safety of anybody. Safety is already being taught. Consent's already being taught in our schools. Affirmative consent is what's not being taught, and that's because affirmative consent's got nothing to do with consent and everything to do with creating an atmosphere of distrust and hatred.
It's an anti-concept.
Most definitely. We're getting very close to the top of the hour. Paul, any last comment you might want to make that we haven't covered or that you might want to have gotten in there before we left?
Well, I'll just point out that, you know, this is a levels of advance through the sexual, you know, act. They're saying, I need consent at each stage, and we've seen that in the comedy there. Question to yourself, how would you know what another person thought was a next step in the sexual adventure that you're having on one some evening? Is it really a next step if I go from your mouth to your neck, or maybe not? And does everybody get to have their own rule book, personal rule book? And if so, how do we know what your rule book is? Or should the university try and set up a catalog that explains every single possible transition from this to that, from that to this, so that everybody knows, and that the book's about 3 inches thick? I mean, there's just no way you can know what a next step is, or at least know with complete certainty. And therefore, again, a legal minefield is set up by this affirmative consent.
Paul McKeever, thanks for joining us today. We certainly could have been talking about this for hours and hours. At this point, I must ask everyone for their consent to end our show for today, and whether I get it or not, the show must go on, but not till next week, when we'll continue our journey in the right direction. Until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Now it's time for our bonus round. You know how it works, Mark. You have 30 seconds to win Ariel's consent. Are you ready, Mark?
Okay.
Go!
I was wondering if you're not busy.
No.
There's gonna be a party at the frat house.
No.
Can I kiss you?
No.
Can I put my hands on your buttocks?
No.
Do you want to do it or what?
No!
All right, Ariel, congratulations! You win a trip for you and Mark to Acapulco!
No!
Woo! You will spend two nights in Acapulco at the Lover's Hideaway Beach Hotel.
Oh, this is so wrong!
I want to thank our contestants and the Date Rape players. Come on, everybody, let's give them a big kiss goodbye.